Well, thanks for inviting me here. I'm delighted to be here. It's my first visit to not only to Bergen, but to Norway, and it's only my second visit to Scandinavia. I mean, a couple of years ago, I went to a conference in Malmö, and that's my experience of Scandinavia. What I want to talk about is the three topics are related to each other, though today I won't be talking about Nietzsche, Wittgenstein, and on Wednesday I won't be talking about Wittgenstein. There is, in my eyes at least, a very Wittgensteinian strand that goes through all these things. Today's lectures and Wednesday's lecture are actually part of a new book project, which is on political philosophy. I realized that Wittgenstein himself was not much of a political philosopher, but one might pick up some ideas or some ways of approaching issues from him that bear on thinking about politics, and I hope some of that will come through today. So what I have here is actually the very first chapter of that book on politics, and I begin by saying that it's remarkable that in the last few decades there has been this renewed interest in political philosophy. When you go back to the early phases of the analytic tradition in philosophy, I'm thinking here about the 20s and 30s and 40s, even maybe 50s, you will find that there was no interest in political philosophy at all. It just didn't exist. Ethics, maybe marginally, so meta-ethical questions, but otherwise political issues were not really on the agenda. And I think the same thing is true of other 20th century movements in philosophy, phenomenology, existential philosophy, hermeneutics, at least all in their earlier phases had a minimal interest in political issues. But then in the 1980s that began to change, and since then there has been a whole flood of writings in political philosophy coming from different directions. So the question of the value of democracy as a system of government has been discussed. The issue of freedom, political liberty, and also to some extent political equality have been issues in widely debated. And above all, of course, there has been a lot of philosophical haggling, one might say, about the precise formulation of principles of political justice. I won't mention names here. That, I think, is appropriate, given the importance, the impact that politics has had and keeps having on our lives. So it's appropriate that we as philosophers think about political matters. But I'm struck by the fact that though the literature is very extensive, it is in some ways also extremely narrow and far away from what one might find in the classical tradition, going all the way back to Plato and Aristotle, thinking about Machiavelli and Hobbes and other figures. It's narrow in the sense that it is and aims to be a completely normative or prescriptive enterprise. It's always connected with this question, what is the right system of government? What value, what significance are we to attach to liberty or equality? Or how are we to implement the idea of justice? So they are normative. It's a normative and prescriptive theory. And some political philosophers indeed think of their enterprise as, in some ways, an applied ethics. That's the view. And that is an interesting and understandable, and much interesting work is done in this direction. But it's nevertheless extremely narrow, because when we look at the tradition, look at Plato and Aristotle, for instance, or look at Machiavelli and Hobbes, the names I've mentioned, then we discover that apart from prescriptive issues, there is of course also in the writings of these authors a concern with questions of the reality of the political phenomena themselves, trying to grasp them in some theoretical or philosophical manner. So what I want to argue is that what is really missing from our current interest in political philosophy is what one might call a political ontology. comparable of, in some ways to what some philosophers today, like my colleague John Searle, pursue as social ontology, the ontology of social reality. And we still need and we ought to devote ourselves also to this question of the ontology of political phenomena. Let me describe this the issue for a moment in terms of by comparing politics to games, let's say to chess in particular, right? So before you can teach somebody how to play a game of chess well, you have to describe to them something about the nature of the chessboard, the different figures, the different moves they can make, and so on. You have to describe what I might roughly call the constitutive rules of the game. And only then, after you have done that, can you give strategic rules, rules for doing well, playing the game well, or for winning strategy, strategies, right? So that has to, the prescriptive and normative element in the theory of chess has to come second after the constitutive. And I want to make an additional observation here, specifically interesting with respect to chess, namely that typically it's not enough to be told that, let's say, you must always keep your king protected, or don't sacrifice pieces unnecessarily, or some general chess playing rules. If you want to become good at playing chess, you also have to study the individual games of chess masters. Rules are not enough, right? So if we think about politics as a game, which may be useful and illuminating, then one could say, in politics too, you have to understand, first of all, the nature of the constellations of the realities out there, what the possibilities are, the possible moves, so to say, in that game. And only afterwards, after you have done that, can you then say how that game is to be played, or what winning strategies you ought to be pursuing. And there too, in politics, it's not enough to state general principles, rules, the thing that our political philosophers have been so concerned with. You also have to look at how people actually conduct themselves in politics. Right? So to become a competent political agent, you can't just seek to understand John Rawls's principles of justice, for instance. You also have to think about this question, how do actual politicians proceed, right? And what can I learn from them? Of course, one has to be careful here. Politics, if it's a game, it's certainly a game of a different kind from chess, right? Because chess, like many other games, has a fixed set of constitutive rules. Given situation, what defines the game is fixed for us, relatively speaking, historically, but it's relatively fixed. There are definite understandings of what constitutes winning and losing. And finally, there is an established body of mastery in the field. And when we look at politics, of course, the situation is somewhat different, right? Because in politics, the initial conditions are themselves variable, right? They are not fixed once and for all. Yes, there are rules for goals we can formulate, principles we can formulate in politics that we want to pursue, but these are always contested typically, right? And moreover, it seems that these rules are only defined and specified in the process of the game itself. They aren't being brought to the game from outside. And finally, of course, what counts as genuine and valid political experience from which one can learn is always up for grabs, right? So the game of politics is a much more open-ended game than the game of chess would be. And that certainly would be important when we start trying to think about this question of an ontology of politics. So what I'm trying to do here is to fill this gap that I see here to some extent and think about political reality. So do political philosophy not in this prescriptive and normative thought. I've sometimes been told by my students that because I don't always discuss the fine-tuning of Rawls's principles of justice, I'm not really doing political philosophy, I'm told. I'm only reading Aristotle and Hobbes, let's say. They don't really count. But I don't care. So what I want to talk about today is, and on Wednesday as well, are some aspects of this this project. And I want to begin at a point which in some ways may seem to be, well, it's one point where I can begin, but may seem to be also the most fundamental or primary issue, and that being why there is such a thing as politics at all, or why and in what sense we are political beings. Is being political in some ways and having political institutions, is that somehow essential to us as human beings? Could we do without it? Could we imagine ourselves without these institutions or without these practices? Or is that somehow built into our nature? Of course, the question arises, is serious, because as we know, 19th century anarchism challenged that assumption that somehow politics is natural or essential to our being. It argued politics is only the product of historical and contingent circumstances. And then the modern right-wing contemporary version of anarchism, the cousin of anarchism, right-wing cousin of anarchism, you might say, modern libertarianism, again challenges us and says, why do we need these institutions? Can't we simply reduce them to their very minimum, right, and be left alone to live our lives? So is it conceivable that we do away with our institutions and with political activity, or we minimize it in some fashion or other? Or is it somehow impossible because being political is deeply grounded in who we are, deeply in our nature? Are we naturally political beings? Of course, you might have two different views of the other possibility, that we are political only for historical and contingent reason. You might think of it in the way that the anarchists and libertarians do, is that we are therefore should aim to rid ourselves of politics as far as possible, or minimize it at least. Or you could think that, like historical culture, it's a human achievement, right? And therefore something that we should value as a historical and contingent achievement, that we would want to have as a historical and contingent achievement. So anarchists and libertarians on one side say it's historical contingent and we're better off without it, but Aristotle certainly, in some ways, but even more prominently Hannah Arendt in the 20th century have argued that no, politics is a profound human achievement without which we would be worse off, less human, just as we would be less human if we had no theater or had no art, though it is conceivable that we might be without it. So I want to talk here about, and this is really the theme of my talk today, I want to talk about this question, what we should think about the proposition that we are political beings by nature, we are naturally political beings. And Aristotle is, of course, the primary exponent, maybe the originator of this kind of political naturalism. The proposition that we are by nature political beings occurs, in fact, in the first book of Aristotle's Politics. But there are modern versions of political naturalism, too, and they sometimes arise at a surprising place, namely not in philosophy or political theorizing, but in biological theorizing. So sociobiologists and ethologists have in recent years claimed that there are certain biological fixed characteristics about us which inevitably have made us into the political beings we are. So there are two forms of political naturalism that I want to talk about, the Aristotelian one first, and then this sociobiological one, or one particular case of the sociobiological case in the other. Now, Aristotle is interesting because he is, as I said, a political naturalist, But inside this political naturalism, there are also thoughts which in some ways undermine it, or which put it into question, or which raise issues which then lead one to think that maybe that our being political is something much more historical and something much more contingent about us than we may have thought. So you could call that a tension or a contradiction in Aristotelian thought, but it's useful to think about both as an exponent of this naturalistic view of politics and as someone who leads us beyond it. So when, as I said, Hannah Arendt, for instance, very strongly emphasizes this contingent feature of human politics, she is quite deliberately and consciously drawing on Aristotelian conceptions. So let me begin with Aristotle then. As I said, the formula appears in the first book of Politics, and as you know, our rhetoricians, our orators still on special occasions like to kind of quote that formula, namely that man is by nature a political being. Aristotle, of course, put all this in Greek, and he said anthropos, physē, politikon, so on. Four words, right? And it turns out, in order really to understand what he meant, and whether we still understand it in the way that Aristotle did, one really has to look at each one of these four terms. And it turns out the situation is much more complex. It's not at all clear we grasp very readily what he was after. And so let me start with the... I want to look at each one of these four terms respectively and see what we can get out of it. And let me start with the most general one, namely physis, right? Nature, we say. Aristotelian nature is not really our nature. So nature for us is something material to begin with, right? And it's subject to causal necessity, and it's governed by mechanical laws. You could say these are sort of three characteristics that we ascribe to physics, to nature, to the physical. But what is physical to Aristotle is, of course, something quite different. Namely, the physical has an inherent, what is natural has an inherent telos or purpose or direction built into it. It's directional, right? Or teleological, we say. And the physical is something that is potential. It has a potentiality which realizes itself or may not realize itself, right? So the acorn, one of Aristotle's examples, so has the potential become an oak tree. That's its nature, its physis. But of course it may not, right? If the conditions aren't right, if there's enough water, if it's too hot or too cold, no oak tree. So what belongs to physis is natural in some ways, but it's not natural in the mechanical way. It's not that it's necessarily there. It is there in that it has a potentiality to be something. Well, we have this idea that, of course, then somehow the genes are... for instance, in the biological, so this is a biological conception of nature that Aristotle has, and we still have this picture in our own view, namely that particularly when we think of living beings, that there's genes, there are chromosomes, and these somehow determine what the potential organism of the organism is. But of course, for Aristotle, whatever determines this, what is the origin of the fully developed object is not something material at all. It's not a gene or a chromosome. It's something non-material which attaches itself to the matter. It is what he calls a form. So that everything has a form, right? And this form determines what the thing can and will, under the right conditions, become. The important contrast is that between physis and nomos. Right? Physis is, you could say, what can become by itself without human interaction. Nomos, what is by nomos, so we have physis and nomos. Nomos is an interesting word. Physis comes from phio, which means to grow, of course. So it has already built in this biological kind of idea. Nomos, I mean that which is not by physis, by nature, we might say, which exists by custom or culture. So in some ways, Aristotle is making this distinction between nature and culture. Nomos is a term that whose etymology connects interestingly enough with most directly with a German verb, nehmen, German, right, which means to take, right? So nomos is what we acquire, what we take, what we make up, right? So physis is what comes of itself, by its own, without human intervention, let's say. Whereas what exists by nomos is what requires precisely human intervention, human action. So the oak tree, the acorn, will by itself, under the right conditions, become the oak tree. Doesn't require human nurturing necessarily. That's what exists by physis. Whereas what exists by nomos is local, it's made, it's cultural. It doesn't exist all the time. Right? So we are by nature, that's by physis, he says, Aristotle says, political beings. Which means we are always and inevitably physical, right? Political, sorry, yeah. Always and inevitably political. But being always and inevitably political doesn't mean that we actually always and inevitably practice politics, that we actually are active, really living in a political world, a real political agent. It only means that we always and without human intervention have this potential and in fact the disposition to become political when the occasion arises. So though we are naturally political, this doesn't for Aristotle mean that we are necessarily political, right? It only means we are potentially so. And this potentiality is given to us. And what, it turns out, what is involved in being political is that we can then, as political beings, create for us culture, customs, and of course also laws, right? So laws, nomos is also a word that applies to law. So laws as well are nomos. And so Aristotle ends up, in fact, saying something very paradoxical. He says that we are, by nature, beings of culture. Being cultural or being political, therefore, is part of our nature. Well, let me go to the second word, so, physis, right? So on is the more specific word. So on means living beings, and as such, living things are distinguished from non-living things by their form, he says, right? There are different kinds of species, different kinds of organisms, and therefore there are different kinds of living beings that have different form, right? And each of these determines a telos, a goal, an outcome. So each form determines what the thing can potentially be and what under certain conditions it will become. So for us, for our species, our telos is that we become political. But it turns out there are certain things we share with other human beings, with other living beings. So though we each have, each human species has its own form, nevertheless, there are similarities and relationships between these different forms. And so it turns out there are in fact degrees of being political, and some other species already are political to some extent. So in the Politics, in Book One again, Aristotle writes, a human being is more of a political animal than a bee or any gregarious animal. So there are degrees of being political, right? So how are these to be understood? Well, the first thing about being political is that, of course, only gregarious animals, he says, we have a word for that, gregarious animals are political, but not all gregarious animals. So we have the gregarious animals. Not all gregarious animals are political, but not all are to the same degree. Well, they must fulfill certain conditions. Namely, the first one, he says, are such that, so they are also there, of course, they are also the solitary, right? And so some animals are solitary, but we are concerned here only with the gregarious animals. And some gregarious animals are such that they kind of move together, relate to each other, but in doing so, each one of them is just pursuing its own well-being. And he says, think of fish, right? Herrings, all kind of swimming together, but each herring really wants to survive and looking for food, but nevertheless, they all move together. And so this is, they have really no common goal. So there are some animals, that gregarious animals, that just live together in some ways, in close conjunction, but they don't have a common goal, and there is a kind of a more specific form of gregariousness, namely where the animals have a common goal. Think of some hunting animals going on hunt together, some lions, right? And so they have a common goal they pursue, whereas the herrings do not, he thinks. Fish certainly are not political. Then he says there are those who seem to have some kind of social organization. They have a ruler, he says. So they are, have rulers. For instance, he says, there's the queen bee, right? So there are some animals, particularly the gregarious insects, where they are rulers. And then there's a third group who have a fixed habitat. So, and these constitute three degrees of being political. So some animals only have the common goal, others have common goal and rulers, others have common goal and rulers and a fixed habitat. They are more political, and among these here, this third group, are of course the bees again. That's why he mentions those. And human beings. So we share this form and there are degrees of being political. But human beings, of course, have their own distinctive form of life, and so their being political has to be something different again from that of these other animals. They are more political still. And the question is, how is that so? So man is a political animal, human beings, anthropos, in a higher degree, he says, than other gregarious animals, even higher than the bees. How is that possible? Well, because we have our own distinctive form, some characteristic which we share with no other animals, namely a distinctive capacity to use language, logos. And logos, of course, which has many connotations, it means deliberation, argument, reasoning, but also language. Logos allows us to reflect on the forms of cooperation and cohabitation in which we engage. So for us, in contrast to the bees who always live in the same regime, our political systems are variable. We can reflect on the question, which is better, monarchy, democracy, autocracy, aristocracy, and so on. And we can do that because we have logos. Logos allows us to form concepts, to argue, to reason, to come to make choices. And so we are therefore political in a very different way from the animals. So he calls it a question of degrees, in fact, is much more than degree. Here is a really a threshold passed, right? But it is logos that makes us the particular kind of political beings we are, because it gives us these choices. It allows us, he says, to distinguish between the good and the bad, and the just and the unjust. So, he of course says, because logos is, having logos is what makes us human, therefore we can define a human being as one that has logos, logikon, so on, logikon, right? That's a definition of human being. But because it's logos that makes us also political in the way we are, uniquely so, we can also define human beings as zoon politikon. And the two definitions, so zoon logikon and zoon politikon, really come to the same thing. To be political and to be logical is the same thing. Well, let me just add here that, of course, he says at some point, this is at the end of the Nicomachean Ethics, that the highest form of life is, of course, not that of gregarious animals, the human existence, this political existence at all. The highest form of life is that of pure meditation, because there we are most like the divine. But, he adds, unfortunately, we are, and this is a wonderful word here, we are only human. We are only human. And because we are only human, we also have needs and have to take care of these needs. And we can do so only by cooperating with each other. And therefore, though the highest form of existence is that of contemplation, even the sage has to be in some ways a political being. You can't escape being political, right? Though there is something still higher than that. So, human beings have logos, they are political, but again, one has to say, having logos is only a potentiality. Right? It's something that we are capable of, but it doesn't always get fully developed. And so he says, unfortunately, it only gets developed occasionally to the fullest. So slaves, yes, they can still speak language. Maybe they know some Greek, for instance. Maybe if they're foreigners, know some broken Greek, right? And so they have some kind of logos, but they don't really have full possession of logos, of reason. Children, they don't have don't get born with language, and so they don't have logos to begin with, but they have the capacity later to develop logos. And then there are women who do speak Greek, admittedly, but he says they have logos without authority. That is, men just won't listen to them when they speak about politics, right? That's natural, yeah. So it turns out, yes, anthropos, human beings, all have logos, but in fact, most human beings don't have logos to the extent to which they are actually capable of being political at all. It's not even enough to be just a free male, a non-slave male, because if you're occupied with practical needs and necessities, you can't really pursue a political existence. And so the only truly political person is a man who is a free man to begin with, an educated man who can reason well, but also somebody who is freed from human necessity. He doesn't have to pursue a job. There are those who unfortunately need to work. But they are what he calls banausoi, mechanics, mere mechanics. They can't really do politics. They can't be political. So it turns out, though all human beings are distinguished by the fact that they are political beings, only in the rarest of cases can such beings actually actualize their capacity, namely as free, independent human males. Maybe even as Greek males, because the others only can say things like barba, 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 and are called barbarians as a result. Right? So, number three. So I've talked about physics, I've talked about very shortly about zoon, I've talked about And now talk about anthropos, what it means to be human. Now let me talk finally about politikos, what does he mean by politics? Well, the important point, of course, is here that this word comes from polis, right? And polis is, for the Greeks, certainly for Aristotle and for Plato, a very specific kind of institution. We translate polis often as state, a complete mistake. A polis is not just any kind of political system. It is a very specific sort of political organization. We also sometimes say city-state or city, also a mistake, because that comes from civitas. That's a kind of a Roman expression and refers to a Roman sort of institution. And then sometimes we, for instance, talk about the Republic, and that famous Platonic dialogue, of course, the Republic. And that is also a mistranslation, because republic, res publica, is once again a Latin word, has nothing to do with the Greeks. And in fact, we would be much better off to have left the title of the Platonic dialogue untranslated, or if you wanted to have it translated, it would be called somewhat awkwardly, the order of the polis. That's really politeia, that's what it means. So when Aristotle says that man is a political, human beings are political by nature, what he means is they are naturally polis dwellers. That is, beings who flourish most when they live in the specific kind of structure that the Greek polis approximates. And he says, he who is without a polis, not without a state or something like this, but without a polis, by reason of his nature and not of some accident, is either a poor sort of being or a being higher than man. You are either a god, then you don't need a polis, or you are really a poor sort if you don't live in Athens, or some ancient Athens, that is, or some polis of that sort. Right? We need a polis then to live a really fulfilled human existence. Without that, in other conditions, you can't be human, fully human. Right? Well, he goes so far as to say that the polis, because it's so fundamental, human existence is in some sense prior, he says, in the order of nature to the household and the individual. And what he means by this is you have to think about human beings in terms of their function, and they can't live, they can't function properly outside the polis. And so unfortunately, a human being outside the polis isn't fully human, in any sense. Which doesn't mean that the polis has always existed. In fact, in the same breath, in the same chapter, he says that the man who invented the first polis was one of mankind's greatest benefactors. So polis are rare, don't always exist, but it's only in the polis that we are really political. Let me jump through some of these particulars, my watch here. So what I've been arguing then is, let me kind of summarize this quickly. On the one hand, Aristotle wants to convince us that being political is completely built into our nature, that as human beings we are constituted in such a way that it is natural for us to be a political being, but that means that we in some ways can strive beyond what is natural too. That is what being political means. And he also says, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, this only gets realized in relatively few situations, and can be realized only in relatively few human beings. Right? That's the nature. So on the one hand, it's completely natural, but it's also completely rare, and it's a historically contingent fact when it occurs. And it has happened to some degree in the Greek polis. And of course, as he is writing this, you might remember he, of course, has been one of the teachers of Alexander the Great. The Greek polis as an independent institution is already coming to an end. So he's, in a way, looking backwards. It's a kind of almost nostalgic view on politics, politics he has. He's looking backwards, and he sees this great potential for a form of human existence which is already at the point of disappearing. Well, let me jump very radically then at this point to the moderns. And I will I talk simply about one particular person, namely the Dutch ethologist or sociobiologist, if you want. The terms are somewhat malleable here. Famous researcher of primates, Frans de Waal, who some years ago wrote a book called Chimpanzee Politics. And this was based on a large amount of animal research at the zoo at Arnhem in the Netherlands, where he observed the behavior of various groups of chimpanzees, and he concluded that these people live in a way which justifies saying that there is that they are really capable of political behavior in a elementary sort. What makes them political? Not that they lived in a polis, of course, right? And of course they didn't know how to speak to each other. What makes them political is rather something quite else. I mean, what he said he observed was that not only were there interactions, binary interactions between a particular chimpanzee individuals, but which were quite complex. I mean, they would extend over long term. These chimpanzees would recognize each other as individuals. They would be in hostile or friendly relationships with each other. They would fight with each other or cooperate with each other, delousing each other and so on. So there are many of these multiple binary relationships. But he said, that's not what is interesting. What is interesting is that there are many occasions when some third animal will intervene in the interactions between the two others. We have to think of here of a process of triangulation. And the characteristic of human politics, of all politics, is in fact such triangulations. It's intervening in the interactions of others. Well, if you want a simple illustration of this, think of participants in a traffic behavior, right, on the road, and so there are all kinds of interactions between the individual drivers, but that is not political. What is political is the lawgiver, for instance, through the police, insisting on certain kinds of behaviors between these, seeking to prevent some and seeking to encourage others. So triangulation is of the nature of politics. That was de Waal's interesting observation. And I think there is something interesting in this, which Aristotle certainly did not understand. Well, clearly there, I mean, de Waal describes this in great detail. It's a very interesting book to read. It's not very philosophical, of course, it doesn't want to be. But it does seem to tell us something about politics, but it's immediately clear de Waal is speaking a completely different language from Aristotle. His political animals are primates and not gregarious insects. And in fact, there's a good reason for this, because from our modern biological point of view, gregarious insects are far distanced from us on the evolutionary ladder to have anything in common with us as political beings, whereas the primates are immediately related to us. But of course, primate behavior is quite different from that of the gregarious insect, where the gregarious insects live in these tightly structured social arrangements with each other. The primates live in very informal arrangements, and that in fact make possible this constant intervention and this constant transformations of binary relationships. So a completely different notion of politics that arises here. De Waal has been criticized for this idea, and saying from sort of an Aristotelian-minded other sociobiologists, saying what he doesn't describe is the interaction between organisms who are not direct kin, they're not related to each other, and that live together in very large groupings. And sort of kind of Aristotelian-minded kind of objection to him. But I think nevertheless he does say something that is of interest here. But nevertheless, of course, there is also important differences here. Interestingly enough, I mean, one of the problems of his account, he is willing to interject into his descriptions of the animal behavior a whole large body of terms that are borrowed from human political language. He speaks about these chimpanzees being involved in economic exchanges, for instance, or forming coalitions, that he says that they are capable of strategic planning within a system of power relations, and so on. So he allows himself a whole wide range of anthropomorphic language, which should make one feel somewhat suspicious. He goes so far as to say that these chimpanzees, and I quote here, would obviously feel very much at home in a political arena. And that surely can't be true, right? Can't be true, because for one thing, these animals, though they may engage in some kind of power interaction of domination, and some kind of play domination roles, in fact, much of de Waal's book is concerned with power struggles between these different chimpanzees. Nevertheless, we can't say, as de Waal says, that this produces a logical coherence and even a democratic structure, he says, to the community of chimpanzees. Let me quote one more sentence. All parties search for social significance and continue to do so until a temporary balance is achieved. This balance determines the new hierarchical positions. When we see how this formalization takes place during reconciliations, we understand that the hierarchy is a cohesive factor which puts limits on competition and conflict. Childcare, play, sex, and cooperation depend on the resultant stability, but underneath the surface, the situation is constantly in a state of flux. And he says, well, that's just exactly how Machiavelli talks about politics. And so chimpanzee politics is not just a metaphor. It's really something already in our pre-human forebears, where the foundations, the genetic foundations, so to say, of our political existence are laid. But of course, you might say, what is really missing from this? Where I think Aristotle gets the better on him, is that what he doesn't see, that these animals, of course, could not partake in any real politics because they don't speak any language. They don't have any language, and they are therefore not capable of doing exactly what Aristotle says is characteristic and definitive of human politics. Namely, they are not capable of reflecting on the social interactions in which they are engaged, and think about them, conceptualize them, and assess them in some ways, and then on the basis of this assessment, make choices about them, right? So they cannot debate on whether a democracy is better than the other, or whether the alpha male chimpanzee shouldn't be got rid of and replaced by a council of matriarchs, right? They are not in a position to make such deliberations. And so they are really not capable of being political in the Aristotelian sense at all. And I think here Aristotle has seen something which is indeed absolutely essential to human politics, that politics is above all human politics about language, or involves above all language. It's a linguistic phenomenon, you might almost want to say. Well, nevertheless, I think one should take de Waal seriously, and sociobiologists like him, and there are many others who write in the same vein, because there is a tendency in contemporary political theory, not so much among philosophers who are focused on these prescriptive normative issues, but among political theorists, whom you typically find in America, at least in political science departments, not in philosophy departments, to consider political theory kind of freestanding, self-contained enterprise, right? William Connolly, for instance, has complained about this and said, no, we have to really see that however human politics is conceived, we are natural and biological beings, and that biological fact of about us bears in some important fundamental way about on who we are. Conrad Lawrence once observed, and I think rightly and very perspicuously, that in evolution the old is rarely discarded in the evolutionary and historical process, but its function is maybe transformed. So there are many features about us. Think of the human appendix, let's say, as one expression of this fact. Even non-functional elements or minimally functional elements in our organism are maintained in the evolutionary process, and so we should therefore say the same thing is probably also true when it comes to human behavior, human action. There too, the biological or biological facts about us, which we can observe already in pre-human populations, will have a bearing on how we should think about ourselves as deliberate, conscious human agents. So Lawrence, this is in his book, Die Rückseite des Spiegels, behind the back of the mirror, I think it's called in English. I says, look at human cognition, right? And here, cognition in general, and what he tries to argue is that our cognitive machinery is actually a composite, evolutionarily speaking, of many separate elements who have grown together syncretistically, and we can understand what they are and how they function only by seeing them as products of this process, which contains many contingent features. So the current structure of the apparatus is not that it is the most appropriate for survival purposes, but the structure of the apparatus has to be understood as the outcome of a process of development of which many steps and traces of earlier phases are still retained in the end. So there is in consequence no inherent necessity, he has maintained, in the particular assembly of capacities that constitute the human cognitive apparatus. Only an evolutionary and historical account can tell us why that apparatus has now for us the current form. So the crucial point is that we will not be able to discern the construction of our cognitive machinery without attending to the history of its formation. We can illustrate this kind of thinking also by reflecting not on evolutionary processes but on historical processes. Think of any of the great European cathedrals, right? And what you observe, of course, is that they have been all built over centuries sometimes. I know, for instance, that the great Gothic cathedral in Cologne was started sometime, well, there are many earlier constructions there in the place, but as a Gothic cathedral, sometime in the 13th century, and was completed only in the 19th century, right? So 600 years of construction. And what you observe, of course, when you look around in these cathedrals, that there are all kinds of different pieces and styles put together. Design has sometimes changed the shape of the thing. The ground plan has been adjusted over time. Different architects have done their work with different aesthetic ideals in mind and so on. And the result of this process can sometimes be jarring even. One has to say, you know, not all these cathedrals are always that harmonious, but many of them have still come out in an interesting way, right? What we admire maybe in the finished building is its organic unity, right? It's precisely that it starts off Romanesque and it ends up Gothic, right? Several hundred years later, and that is what makes it so interesting and what makes it the thing that it is, right? It is itself a record of a history. And a cathedral is not just an aesthetic production, it's a historical monument and a historical evidence of the persistence of tradition and religion over time. That's what it symbolizes, right? Not just an aesthetic value. So exactly the same, I think, can be said about human politics. Human politics, too, is the result of a process that has formed over a very long time and has indeed biological, natural, pre-human, non-human components in it, and we can't understand it without it. What we understand as politics has come together from different sources and been aggregated over time, and in the evolutionary historical development, elements have been added and subtracted. And in this way, the structure of human politics, or what we now have as our political reality, has been slowly enriched and has become both problematic in the way it is and admirable in the way it is, sometimes at least. And with this way, the structure of human politics has slowly enriched. None of this will be immediately apparent to the untrained eye, to the unhistorical eye. We may note, for instance, that of course action is basic to politics. Not all politics is about action, because it's also about structures, institutions, right? Realities. But we may, but what we call an action, human action, is of course itself a peculiar amalgam of physiologically determined patterns of behavior. So they are, in some sense, genetically fixed, and these genetic determinations may come from pre-human sources. Some of what we call action is due to acquired conditioned reflexes. Some to childhood fixations, habituations, conscious learning, deliberate choice, and appropriately descriptive language that interprets all of this. All this. So in human action too, when we think of human action, the way we think, reflect on it, and describe it is itself a constituent element of the action. So actions, as I understand, are not elementary phenomena that you could analyze by purely logical means. They are outcomes of an evolutionary and historical and developmental process, and contain within them as features all these residues of all these stages of the historical process, of the temporal process. So just as in the case of human cognition, or that of European cathedrals, it will prove difficult to distinguish the different layers and levels of the mechanism of action unless we consider the temporal processes through which they have come to be formed. Here too, in other words, the successful understanding of existing structures requires a study of evolutionary and human history. But since actions are constitutive parts of our political reality, the same must, of course, hold for the latter as well. The sociobiologists, the ethologists, I think, understand this, and what they say about the evolutionary basis of human politics is surely of interest. But they typically neglect the later phases of this process in which human politics has come to acquire its distinctive character. Having traced part of the history of this process, history in the broad sense, including evolution, having traced part of the history of the process, the sociobiologists believe to have discovered all of it. But they think that by looking at the way that animals, primates, let's say, behave, and then comparing that, seeing relations from there to human political behavior, they have now understood human political behavior. And the same in every other aspect of human life. That's where the mistake occurs. They neglect, in fact, the most distinctive feature of the historical evolution of human politics. Namely, they fail to discern what Nietzsche, for instance, saw, namely that human politics is not a natural kind. It's not itself a biological or natural phenomenon. It is constituted only by our interpretation of these natural phenomena. And I'll come back to that. In the genealogy of morals, there is a fascinating and shocking sentence which says, there are no moral phenomena. There's only a moral interpretation of phenomena. And you might just say, oh, this is just moral nihilism, right? But I think that's a mistake. What he is saying is what we think of as the moral is not there in the bare facts of, for instance, human suffering or human cruelty or whatever. What we think of as the moral has to do with how we interpret, what sense we make of this phenomena. And I think that's the point he elaborates very clearly in, for instance, the second essay of the Genealogy of Morals. So I'm saying here, Nietzsche understood something about the nature of morality, but can apply that also, and I think he understood that to apply also to politics, that politics does not consist in us fighting with each other or collaborating with each other or doing this or that with each other. The nature of human politics is our capacity of interpreting and making sense in some ways of these facts about ourselves, right? So you could call this a hermeneutic conception of morality and of politics. And what I'm saying is, or what I have been saying here, is that the sociobiologists, much as they are interesting as they may be, our current sort of reductionist tendency to think about everything in these biological and reductive terms. What they miss out is precisely this insight which I have attributed here to Nietzsche. But I think it's an insight which is already in some ways there in Aristotle. That's why I've been talking about Aristotle. Because when Aristotle says, what's distinctive about human politics is that we are logical beings, right? That we are beings who reflect on and can judge and deliberate about political matters. That's really where the essence of human politics lies. Right? So human politics is what it is only because we have given it a specific meaning. This meaning changes over time, of course. Politics becomes something new over time. It acquires new meanings, and these meanings may also lose their force over time. And then we need to give them new meanings if we can. And we may also fail in being able to do that. And at that point, of course, politics may become impossible for us to maintain. So, what I want to talk, this is what I have to say today. What I want to talk about on Wednesday now is this question, in what sense has the meaning of politics disintegrated for us? Right? I want to say, what's fundamental to our political situation today is really, there are many, many practical problems. We have, some very local, specific, but then also these broad questions of modern technology, environmental question, climate, population, and so on. These are practical questions. But beyond that, what is really bothering us, what is really ailing us, is that we have lost any coherent sense of what politics is really about. That there was once for us in our culture such an understanding, that this has disintegrated, and that we are now at one of these moments when, if we want to be political beings, we have to find a new way of interpreting our own reality, our own human reality. That's the challenge. And what I want to argue is that it was Nietzsche who first really understood that this is the task of contemporary politics. Thank you.